Welcome to Bergenomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
Welcome to the Bergenomics podcast. I'm your host, Ross McDowell. In 2022, Australia's live performance industry is valued at approximately $17 billion, employing nearly 65,000 people. One segment of the live performance industry is the Outdoor Music Festival. With me today is a longtime friend who promises to demystify the economics of Australia's most successful outdoor live concert brand, A Day on the Green. Michael Newton, with his wife Anthea, founded A Day on the Green 20 years ago. A Day on the Green is held in predominantly rural winery locations, having a profound effect financially and psychologically on the communities that host A Day on the Green. It's like a mini economic tornado hitting a rural area. In those 20 years, Mick has produced 500 outdoor music events with 4 million ticket sales and some of the biggest names in Australian and global music. Mick, welcome to Bergenomics, and help me out with some of those marquee acts you've hosted in the past and in the future.
G'day, Ross, and thanks for having me on Bergenomics. I don't know if I'm going to demystify it or make it even more confusing for your listeners, but yeah, it's been a wild ride over the last 20 years, and we just thought it was a good idea at the time. Instead of playing in parks or where you can step on dog shit or people are kicking the footy, we thought the romantic ideal of a concert in a winery was a good one, and actually took a leaf out of Lewin Estates' book, who had been doing jazz and opera type stuff. And I used to be an agent at Premier Artists, working for Michael Gudinski, and I thought contemporary lineups in a winery setting was something that might be good, because a lot of my artists were older and they couldn't get on any festivals back in the year 2000, and they were quite frustrated. So it was kind of created for those artists that I represented, and also from a punter's perspective, me being the core demographic. I was just sick of going to pubs and clubs and having a band come on at 11 or 11:30 at night.
And that was on offer then?
It's kind of. There wasn't much else, there was Blues Fest, there was the Big Day Out, there was Home Bake. Like I said, nothing for an older audience or even an older artist. And with my live background and Anthea, my wife's publicity background, we kind of thought that it would be received well by artists, received well by wineries, by the local councils, by media. It just was a seed of an idea that we thought had legs, and here we are. I'm talking to you 21 years later, having done 500 shows.
So give me an idea of the size of the enterprise. How many events per year? How many states? How many? And you've done some in New Zealand. How many people in terms of to produce one event? Give me an idea of it.
Well, our venues or wineries. The smallest one is probably 8,000. The biggest one's, 20,000 plus. Most are in the range of around between 10 and 15,000.
Okay.
This year we'll only probably do about 22 shows this summer. There have been summers where we've done 40 plus when we were really hitting New Zealand hard. There was one weekend I remember we had Diana Krall touring and Tom Jones at the same time, and it was a long weekend and we had 6 shows in one weekend, which is really mental. And we were chartering planes and in and out of airports at God knows what hours. It was too much. And we've always been clamoring after the growth. It's been a very organic growth, but we've always been just, for a long time, we've always been just behind it. But now we're in a real sweet spot where I've got, probably 10 full-time staff in the office.
Yep.
Then we'd have maybe another half a dozen subcontractors who mainly work for A Day on the Green, but then they might spear off and do, you know, Splendor in the Grass or Blues Fest or, you know, some other shows that are out of the Day in the Green season, but they mainly work for us.
How long does it take to put together one show?
It really depends. Sometimes we've had turnarounds of like 3 months where I remember we did some shows with John Fogerty and it happened very quickly. You know, it was like we confirmed it in June, we put it on sale in July and it happened in November.
You know, that's amazing. In terms of what the work involved, that you can just turn it over.
Quick turnaround, yeah. And other times, you know, we'll be working on tour for 2 or 3 years really before it actually happens. You know, Rod Stewart's a good example where we had him coming pre-COVID. The tour got post, you know, and before that we were probably talking about it for 6 months before that. So I don't know, where were we? 2018, 19, we started talking about it. Got postponed, got cancelled the second time because of the second wave. And, you know, here he is, he's coming in 2022 in March. So that one was a long time coming. Other artists we've sort of talked about for a long time and then ended up confirming, you know, and then doing tours with. It sort of varies, but I've lost the thread of your question. But, you know, we've got, and on the day, you know, apart from the full-time staff and the subbies that I just mentioned, then we'll have, you know, like 100 security, you know, 200 bar staff.
Which you draw a lot of those people from the local areas.
Yeah, we do.
In terms of the local economy and the areas that you're in, roughly what sort of percentage of of your people on site would be local?
It's a good question. Sometimes, you know, you've got to get security from, I'm just thinking of security, from Melbourne to go to a show like Albury or Geelong. But certainly bar staff, you know, some ushers, some people on the ticketing gates. Even in Orange, we get, you know, the local rugby union club to help us load in the stage gear, which is great. Okay. We always try and engage like a local club where we can, you know, donate some money for them just when we need hands-on kind of, you know, workers. Yeah, it's hard to put a number on it, but I know, you know, a council did a study for us, and if we have, say, 10,000 people at a show, aside from what's spent at the show on tickets and booze and food and et cetera, and merch at the show, the spend would be $250 a head injected into a local economy. So that could be, you know, $2.5 million for, is that right? Yeah, for 10,000 people. But, you know, anecdotally we hear that, you know, accommodation's always booked out in the Hunter Valley or in Orange or around Geelong.
And you said there's pressure when you haven't held a show in an area. Venues come back to you and say, hey, we want you back. What's going on? We will spend money, capital money, big money, in making the site even better just to attract you back.
Yeah, a good example of that is in the Southern Highlands, you know, down in Bowral, south of Sydney, where we were playing at Centennial Vineyards for, you know, 3 or 4 years. But the venue would get really rain affected. So we probably cancelled, you know, 4 or 5 out of 10 shows. And our insurance premium increased dramatically, which is a really big cost of business for us.
Can you give me any sort of advice?
It can be 4% of the gross.
Gee.
Yeah, that would include artist non-appearance as well. But the insuring for weather, rain, you know, fire, all that, it's expensive now. And you see the news, you hear the news reports about, you know, people can't even insure their house in some of these flood-prone areas. Well, the same happens for us in some of the markets we play, like the Hunter Valley and southeast Queensland. Our premiums have gone up naturally because of, you know, what's happened in the last 5 years.
Is that your number one biggest risk in running an event, the weather?
Probably weather, yeah.
What would be your number two?
Risk?
Just bums
on seats, yeah. But back to Bowral, the owner there, to his credit, you know, we had to stop doing that show because the insurance premium had gone up so much. So we stopped doing the show, the insurance premium went down. We probably haven't played in Bowral for 10 years, and the owner there just kept getting harassed in the supermarket and the service station and wherever he was about when are you doing more shows, when are you doing more shows. To his credit, he spent nearly $1 million on another site on his property that has, which wasn't the old site, because the old site was a big amphitheater with a bloody dam behind the stage. You don't need to be a genius to know that the where the water's going to go as soon as it rains. And, you know, being city folk, we didn't really think that through. But anyway, he's spent a fortune on this other site, and it's a fantastic 12,000 capacity, fully functional site. And we've had Crowded House play there. We've got Sting coming up. We've got Rod Stewart coming up. So we're back in Bowral on a site that can handle the weather. It hasn't affected our insurance premium.
I don't think people realise just how much money you do pump into a local economy because of things like people driving there. They've got to fill their car up with fuel when they get there. There's own accommodation, not just the your own expenses of what you're putting into that local economy. It's all of your patrons as well. The University of Tasmania did a study and they said that the ratio is 3-1 for every dollar spent at a live music festival, $3 is created to go into the local economy, which is a massive amount. So they spent some time quantifying all of that.
Well, just even just the other weekend, Ross, you know, you've got the state government helping out, you know, Frontier put on Billy Joel at the MCG for the only Australian show. There's 77,500 people at the MCG. So credit to the government for giving Frontier that support, because they acknowledge the amount of money that's going into the Victorian economy, let's say, that day. And that day, that same day, we had 20,000 people down at Geelong for the Killers. The Meredith Festival was on. They've got 15,000 people there, right? And that's three high-profile gigs, let alone what's happening in all the pubs, clubs, all over Victoria in one night. That's one night.
Right.
So right there's over 110,000 people attending music shows, so, and plus all the other pubs and clubs. It's really, really very undervalued sector.
But what you're saying is there's an explosion in this area. Demand is going up. There's people got to supply that demand with acts and whatever. You've been through the shift away from music being the profitable area for, well, record sales, and now it shifted into your segment, the live music. That's now, can just talk a bit about that being the predominant segment in the music industry now.
Well, you can have a think about artists like the B-52s, the Pretenders, Blondie, Sting even. They might put out a record, a brand new album now that they've worked on for 12 months. They come to Australia and they say, we've got a new album out, and they're going to sell, like some of those artists might sell 1,000 copies of that record here. Like, I don't know, do you want to listen to a new Blondie, Pretenders, Sting album with new, you know? Or do you want to go see them live when they're playing all the hits? And they might have to, you know, we might have to suffer through a couple of songs from the new album, but we want to hear the hits. That's what people want to hear. And, you know, when you know, Frank Stivala at Premier Artist, my old boss, he used to say, you know, with the Day in the Green, he goes, hum me three songs and they should be on the bill. You know, so those artists, like, you know, and that we've toured very successfully, like Blondie, Simple Minds, B-52s, Pretenders, we've had a lot of success with Cyndi Lauper as well. We've had a lot of success with packaging them up on one bill, like we've had Pretenders and Blondie together, Cyndi Lauper and Blondie together, Pretenders and Paul Kelly together, Simple Minds and the B-52s together, and Devo, Simple Minds, B-52s, Devo, I think it was. It was a great bill. So we try and give people value for money in the package that we present at A Day in the Green. That's what we've always done since we started. That was the idea from the start, going back to how we started. It was like to put contemporary bills in wineries. That was the,
you know. And that's what people wanted, and you and that built, and you packaged.
For So we and then the other idea was, like, you know, you can bring kids under 12 for free, which we still do. You can bring a picnic, you can bring a deck chair, you can bring a blanket, and you can sit around with your family and friends, you know, have a drink, have something nice to eat, and see some bands and go home. And it's, you know, one stage, one day.
Okay. In economics, we always like to talk about supply and demand, and that gets back to pricing, and that gets back to tickets. There's this thing called elasticity, and that means you put the price of something up, and if it's elastic, not as many people want to buy it because they can't afford it.
You know what? I wish we could do that ongoing as the show goes on sale, like airlines do. I'd love to be able to do that. And I think we should be allowed to. But, we call that flexing. So we might have four ticket categories. So we'd have diamond at the front. Let's say we go on sale with 1,500 diamonds. We might have gold behind that. Let's say we've got 2,500 of those. Let's say we've got 3,000 silver behind that, and they're all reserved seats, right? Behind that, we've got 10,000 GA. They're just numbers I'm pulling out.
General admission.
General admission, yeah. We might go on sale and find that the demand for the diamond is not good. So we might move some golds into the diamond, or vice versa. We might move some diamonds into the gold. Might move some silvers out and have to put more GA in, because the GA is usually not always, but usually the most popular ticket. That's, I'm talking 100 and...
Because it's least expensive.
Yeah, yes, correct. And also, it's the experience of the GA, which I like myself. I would be that person, like, where I'm buying six tickets, I'm going with some friends, we're going to sit around, we're going to, you know, have some beers and wine, have some food, watch some bands, have a chat, you know, be able to talk. The band's there, you know, but we're here for the day. And you'll very often get, like, say you've got Simple Minds and V52s. You might get, you know, two of those people in the six saying to the other four, let's go, this is going to be really good, because they're fans of the band, and they drag four with them for the day. Then the other four end up having a good time anyway. Or you're going to have someone who's a really big Simple Minds fan, and they just want to be in the diamond down the front.
But that's an incredibly hard thing for you to pick, isn't it? Quantify. Well, to actually know,
well,
okay.
Well, it's not. It sounds complicated, but it's not. And all you can do, and Michael Gudinski, who was the partner in my business for all those years, he was the best at it. And that's just reading the market and having an instinctual understanding of how much an artist should be, you know, what you're going to pay them, and what the ticket price should be, you know, and what's the breakdown of that ticket price, you know. Or when we've got a venue like Geelong down at Mount Dunedin, which holds 20,000 people, should our GA price there with 15,000 GAs, or, you know, 12, be a little bit less than, say, the Hunter Valley, where the capacity is 12 and we've only got 6,000 GAs.
But you work that out on a break-even basis, don't you? You say, we've got this many seats and we need to sell so many of them to break even with our costs. So, and then after that, we're looking at tweaking it.
Yeah, so we've been stuck before on budgeting for selling a lot of seats at a high ticket price, but can't move them. Or, well, we sell some, but we can't move them, but the GAs keep selling, right? So do we leave the GAs sold out and hope that people are going to buy the seats, you know, the drip feed of sales over time? Or do we just lose a whole section of seats and put it into the GA and sell them immediately?
But that's a timing issue, isn't it?
There's no right answer. Like, you just go on what your gut is and what, you look at your budgets and you think, well, okay, well, let's release 500 GAs, even though it's sold out, and see what happens. More often than not, they sell immediately, even if you don't promote it, you know? And that's when you're not selling any seats, or you're selling fuck all seats at the same time, you know?
So how do you come up with the price of a ticket?
It's always, like any business, really reflected in your costs, you know?
So you know what your costs are.
Yeah, so any of our venues, if I put all the infrastructure in, which is a greenfield show, so you've got to understand, you know, it's just grass. So everything that goes on that grass, I'm paying for. So, you know, our venues, you know, you'll think to yourself, well, that venue there, on an average ticket price of, let's say, $150, it's 4,500 people break even before I even pay and promote an artist. So before I pay for and promote an artist, I know I'm 4,000 break even. So on an average, whatever average ticket price it happens to be. So then, you know, you put someone like Robbie Williams or Rod Stewart or, you know, Jimmy Barnes or Farnham or any artist fee on top of that already existing 4,500, let's say.
Yeah.
Then you kind of know what you're in for. And then you adjust the ticket price accordingly. So, you know, Robbie Williams' fee is going to be very different than John Farnham's fee. So, but the ticket price you'll get for Robbie will be a lot more.
So then you've got to move, if we look at 10,000 seats, you know where your break even is for your fixed costs per se, but then you've got to put your talent, your entertainment act on top of that.
Yeah.
And that moves it more closer to your 10,000 seats.
Yeah.
And you've got a diminishing amount of profit margin at the top, haven't you? What's left over is what hopefully you're going to
take home. You know, these days, you know, artists, those bigger artists, you got, you know, we've done shows with Elton John, with Fleetwood Mac, Robbie Williams. You know they're going to sell out for you if you price it properly. It will sell out, right? So you forecast a sellout for yourself and you hope that you get it. But, you know, the break even, I'm pulling figures out of the air, but the break even, let's call it a 10,000 capacity, let's call it a 20,000 capacity show. The break even could be up around, you know, 18,000.
18,000?
Yeah, which is a lot of people, right?
So, and that includes the artist fee?
Yeah.
Boy, that's pretty fine.
And I'm not, well, it's fine, but you're going to get it, right? You're going to get it.
What sort of percentage of the overall cost is the artist? I mean, that's obviously going to vary.
Well, yeah, it varies.
Let's say you're big international names.
The percentage of the cost, it could be anywhere between 30-40% to like 60%.
That's a massive cost.
Yeah, so there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of give there. Look, I'm not giving away any trade secrets, but sometimes too the artist will be on a guarantee with a bonus after X amount of people that you work out with the agent. So you're paying them a guarantee, then we're going to make some money, and the artist is going to get a bit more if we get to X amount of payers, and I'll share that profit with the artist after he's made his guarantee, I've made some money, then there can be a split between the artist and myself. Yeah?
Right.
Mm. And it's all shifting, it all changes, it all depends on the leverage, depends if the band really, really wants to play today in the green, depends if I really, really want the act and they've got other options, you know? Robbie could probably do another Amy Stadium instead of playing down at Geelong.
So, and does that sometimes happen with other promoters?
You're competing. Well, a really good example is in Brisbane, the Southeast Queensland market, where we've got a really hot venue, and it's, in my opinion, a better play than the Brisbane Entertainment Centre, which is out in Boondall. You know, and it's a bit of a pain in the ass to get out to Boondall. It's a very sterile environment, in my opinion. It's a great venue, but it's in Boondall. It takes a long time to get out. It's hard to get out of the car park. And we are beautifully placed halfway between Brisbane and the Gold Coast. So we're drawing from even the North Coast of New South Wales, definitely the Gold Coast, definitely Brisbane. And it's a stunning, when that venue is on and then we've got a beautiful night, there's nothing like it. We had two nights with Crowded House there recently. You know, we had 13,000 people per night and it was 25 degrees and still and perfect. And, you know, it doesn't get any better. Or you might have Elton John there for two nights and it might rain the first night and it's a bit muddy the second night, but you still got Elton. You know, like when the outdoor experience is good, it's there's nothing better.
Looking at costs, so, okay, they might be 40 to 60% of your cost, of your overall cost base. You must have felt lately with inflation, a lot of your costs are going up. Which are the ones that have stood out in your mind that have gone up the most?
Artist fee, you know, because they're in this same economy as us. They're paying for international airfares. They're paying for, you know, hotels are a cost. I mean, we pay for the hotels, but it still ends up being a show cost, if you know what I mean. Like it's, you know, artist fees are... And the other thing about an artist fees too is Australia is a dream market for a lot of agents and managers because you've got four pretty good promoters.
Who are?
TEG, Chug, Frontier, Live Nation. Then you've got, you know, Secret Sounds. You've got other people coming up through the ranks. There's us as well. So there's a lot of choice.
A lot of choice means...
For them.
They can up the ante?
Yeah, like you're saying, you know, like I remember, you know, that first Leonard Cohen tour that we did when he came back after disappearing for years. You know, I think we had five or six shows on that first comeback tour, and we were in Michael's office, and the agent, and we'd had, you know, Michael had had, or we'd had a joint offer into the agent for Leonard Cohen, and we were in Michael's office, and there was an agent saying, "Listen, you had the offer for so long now. You need either confirm this, or I'm going to take it elsewhere. But you've got 10 minutes because it's just taking to this is bullshit. It's taking too long." So we're sitting there. I got no clue on how big Leonard Cohen's going to be. You know, this was back in 2010 or something like that, I think. Someone else in the room said, "Nah, it's too much money. Don't do it. Don't do it." So other people were on the fence, and Michael. I just saw Michael go into himself, go into his own, and he says, "Nah, we've got to do it. It's fucking Leonard Cohen." You know, rings the agent, confirm it. Done. So it was done, and then we go on sale. It goes through the roof. Of course, it was a game changer for A Day in the Green because we've got these incredible shows with Leonard Cohen. I'm at the shows just like beside myself because it was that good. But you know, but then even with Leonard, you know, we confirmed that tour when the dollar was 97 against the US, and when we settled the tour, it was 63 or 64 cents.
So in terms of exchange rates,
With that tour, we've got full houses and we're breaking even. I can't even remember what the artist fee, and I'm not saying it's this, but if you've got $500,000 guarantee for an act in US and you're confirming at 97 and you're settling on 63, what's that? You're losing, that's 150 grand right there.
So you've said to me that now you're negotiating in Australian dollars for these artists.
Now
that's the change.
Yeah, that's the change. And there are a few, like I just know what we've got coming up, right, in the next 2 years. I'd say of the things we're doing, five out of six are in Australian dollars, and one's in American, one's in US. So yeah, that's where we're going. And I've got offers to other acts now that are in Australia, which have been accepted. And previously I've worked with the same artist and I've paid them in pounds. And now it's gonna be the good old Aussie dollar.
Because you wanna reduce your risk.
I just wanna know what I'm paying.
And yeah, it's probably, you haven't got a person sitting somewhere in your organisation that's very good at predicting
foreign exchange. We did have one. And even he always used to say, it's no point. He said, by the time you pay to lock it in, you're going to lose the money, and you know what I mean? Like, if it stays the same or better, you're worse off. So
you're just going to guess it the whole time.
Yeah, but we're like any other importer, where we suffer.
Because of it.
With it, yeah.
Give us some idea of the cost of these international acts compared to the Australian acts, and give me some idea of their pulling power compared to the local acts.
Well, you can put a local lineup on and put six really solid Australian bands on and still draw 10,000 people, you know. But your average ticket price might be $130, $150, yeah? But then you'll have an international act with an average ticket price of, you know, 180 or 90, and you're still pulling 10,000 people. So that difference there of that average ticket price is probably the difference in the fee.
Right.
You know, because I mean, mostly my costs are fixed unless you have some, you know, a really big act like Robbie or Elton where there's like 60 or 70 people on the road and you've got to, you know, we've got to put them somewhere backstage and cater, and you know, the production's much bigger.
Your costs are just,
yeah, it's just like, you know, a production for an Elton John show compared to a Noiseworks show, no disrespect to Noiseworks, is like off the chart different. It's on another planet different.
Okay, so again, exposure, but you price accordingly. So
yeah,
if these artists are increasing their costs to you,
mm-hmm.
and that's the largest component cost in your your enterprise, you're going to pass that straight through to ticket price.
Have to. Well, how else am I going to get it?
Yeah.
It's like any other business. Like, in, you know, and that's what I was saying earlier, like, you know, with the airlines being able to flex, like, at will, randomly, yep. I wish we could. I wish we could say, oh, you know, we go on, say we went on sale, we gone, oh, this is, like, a lot hotter than we thought. I wish after a day I could just put the ticket price up 20% across the board.
Why can't you?
I think you... I don't know if it's even... You know what? I don't even know if it's against... What is it? ACC or...
A triple C.
Yeah. Or
why can't you flexibly price your tickets? So it's a market. It's not against any law to be able to say the price reflects the market. That's what really the whole Australian economy is about, is supply and demand, and free market.
From what I know, the reason we don't do it is because you just get too many complaints
about it.
Yeah. I don't think it's against...
It hurts your brand.
Yeah, I don't think it's against any law. But, you know, promoters are now finding very flexible ways of ticketing. Like, you can sell aisle seats in arenas for more money than the middle of the row. You know what I mean?
Okay.
You can... put some tickets on hold where there might be sort of like an auction thing going on. But again, the promoter doesn't get that. You know, if an artist's on a percentage, it's going to the band. It's not going to the promoter.
The other day I was having a talk to Michael Roberts, who's been Hunter and Collectors manager for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
He was telling me that Taylor Swift, on one of her last tours, she could fill seven times the amount of seats she could sell, seven times the amount of seats that was sold for that tour.
For her. Yeah, so she could have gone, yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
And I said to him, not being a wizard in the music business, I said, well, why on earth wouldn't she just then keep on increasing the price of her tickets? So you're still only left with however many venues she was going to play at. But you've only, your costs are the same, but you're making a whole lot more money. And he said, because you just kill your fan base.
Yeah. Well, with Taylor especially, you know, Ed Sheeran's another one where you're going to have probably two mums, or a mum taking two or three kids. And, you know, they're very savvy artists. They are very savvy artists, and they get their pricing right. They don't want to disillusion people with high pricing. They don't want to gouge. You know, they've got to come back as well, remember. So when you say that, the way those guys tour is they tour, they sell out, there's still demand in the market, they put on a hot show, they've priced it well, and then they're setting themselves up for another tour, and the one after that, and the one after that. Ed Sheeran's and Taylor, like, Ed never has never supported anyone in Australia. He's never done Splendor, he's never done a festival, he's always just come and it's been Ed. And Michael had so much to do with Ed's career globally, not just in Australia. Very, very much involved. He's even got a statue of Michael in his bar at home. I'm serious, he has.
Let's talk about COVID for a sec.
Well, that was fun, wasn't it?
That just smashed you, didn't it?
Yeah, smashed us. We had an enforced break. We postponed and cancelled so many tours. We had everyone on JobKeeper. It was extremely frustrating. And, you know, I think the music business is very resilient. We're a very positive lot. And we always had an eye to the future. And we, you know, we got by just.
Have you found that since, listen, I want to say COVID finished, but it hasn't finished, but in terms of now you've got a free system where you can run as much as you want, is there pent-up demand and you're really seeing that in terms of ticket sales? People want to get out and have great fun.
There seems to be, but there, at the same time, there's a lot of shows on sale at the moment. There's a lot of product out there. I think it feels to me right now that the market is a little bit tired. You know, we've had so many interest rate rises, you know, the inflation, coming into Christmas, you know, discretionary income's tight.
Do you feel that?
Oh, yeah.
Do you see that in terms of your sales?
Yeah, you see it when you go on sale. You go, oh, that's really a bit softer than I thought it would be. Or you talk to another promoter, you know, Michael Koppel at Live Nation or Chuggy, and they say, yeah, it's okay, but it's not as good as we'd have hoped. But the shows aren't till March, and I think we're going to be okay given we've got time.
Do you look at things such as you mentioned discretionary spending, then interest rates are going up, discretionary spending, the Reserve Bank would hope it's going to go down because that's the reason why they're putting up interest rates. Do you look at that ahead and go, I'm going to change the type of acts that we're going to have at a day on the green because I think I'm going to have to rely more upon what older people that may have more money?
We do. What our philosophy is at the moment is back winners. That is like the Robbies and the Rods and Sting, Florence Machine. Don't do too much. There's already enough competition without us competing with ourselves, you know. So we're careful. You know, there's more tours coming next summer too. I can't tell you. It's just like the traffic. You always think, oh, it can't be any busier than it was last summer, but it ends up being the same, if not worse. You know, so. And I think you just got to put on quality shows. You know, I'd like to think that Day in the Green's got some sort of, you know, meaning or cachet of putting on good shows. And we just got to be really careful with our packaging of, you know, who we present and our ticket pricing, which we've been talking about.
Let's keep it going.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a very specific question. I would imagine not a lot of people who listen to the Burgonomics podcast know this. But I'd like to ask you, what's more difficult, putting on a Day in the Green concert, or including its preparation, or preparing and swimming the English Channel, of which you are one of the 1,832 people to have done?
1,000 and what?
832.
Yeah, I heard the strike rate's only 10%, which is...
Only 5,000 people have climbed Mount Everest. So,
yeah, right. You know, I mean, yeah.
Boy, you were even a very select group. Look, that's harder.
The channel was definitely harder.
I can remember you going up and down that 50-metre pool at NSAC, 15 kilometres every morning for how long? Months.
Well, I the first time I tried, I got bursitis in the shoulder, so I had to stop. And I booked the pilot boat already, and so I think I lost my deposit on that, but I rebooked it for 1 year after. And then I sort of had gave the shoulder a rest, got some good body therapy around it. I had a really good myo and a really good acupuncturist. Anyway, I got through it. Yeah, but the channel was when I think about it, actually starting a Day in the Green and all the energy and the hard work that it took was pretty good, the channel was another level. And you know, the training was just ridiculous, and the eating was the worst. Like, I'm 85 kilos now. When I swam the channel, I was 105.
Because you put that on because of
the cold. Yeah, and I just remember going, we're here in Albert Park, and going down and having, first of all, I had breakfast. Then the morning tea would be an almond croissant and a chocolate Big M. nearly every day. It's really hard to train when you're 20 kilos overweight.
Now, that's not all you did. You went in the Manhattan race too and got really sick.
Got shockingly sick.
Tell us about that.
Well, I don't know what happened. Manhattan, I was going really well. And then we got up around it's the Harlem River, which is the top. You start in Battery Park and you go up the East River. Yeah, yeah. And they were talking about it in the briefing, that when you get to the Harlem River, it becomes like it's fresh water. Not that it's fresh, but I mean, it's like, do you know what I mean? Fresh water.
Yeah,
not salt.
You're not buoyant.
Yeah, you're not buoyant. And I remember hitting it, and it was much colder, and I could hardly see my arms in front of my body, and it was really stunk. It was really quite putrid. And I must have swallowed water. I don't know what happened, but I came out of that around the top of Manhattan, started going down the Hudson, and I felt really sick. And luckily, the Hudson's got a tide going down towards Battery Park again. So there's a bit of tide assist there. But I was so sick. And my mum was there. She came to New York with us. And I got out of the water. And I must have looked bad, because I remember her saying, "Can someone call an ambulance?" Right? So I'm in the ambulance, and I get to the Beth Israel, what was it called? A big hospital in New York anyway. And I'm there in my Speedos, there's heroin overdoses, there's old people fucking dying, and, I'm just there in the bed in the Speedos, and they've taken my oxygen levels, and it's 66%, right? And I said to the doctor, "What does that mean?" And they said, "Well, you really should be dead." But I was in there for about 4 days. In intensive care for a couple, and then in the general ward with God. I can hardly even remember it because I was sick, it came out of that, and I was good as gold. I was perfect after that. I came good really quickly.
Not many would equate what you do as a day job to the level of fitness required, commitment, self-discipline.
Mm. Yeah, but they both do. They both require that.
And that's probably the reason why you are very good at a day in the green, because you do have that.
I'm really, really fortunate that, obviously swimming is a kind of a solo pursuit, but with a day in the green, I've got to say, I've just had the most incredible staff over the years who've worked hard with us. Anthea, my wife, just an unreal asset to push us all along. Having Michael as a business partner.
Michael Gudinski?
Yeah, it was just, like I said to him, a couple of years ago, I said, "Michael, I don't think I actually sat down with him when I was really happy that happened. I sat down with him and said, I never actually said to you, that I can't believe how lucky I am that you're my business partner. I said, if I'd have known that when I was like 30, that you were going to be my business partner for 20 years, I wouldn't have believed it. And I just want to thank you for like hanging in with us and being part of it and helping us." And we had a really, really good conversation after that. But Michael would get pulled every which way, by people wanting this or that or the other thing, I really miss him. It's such a great guy. I'm just looking at that photo of him over there on the wall. He was a one-off. He really was. Mm. And I know you interviewed him at one stage, didn't you? Remember you coming in here when I was at the agency.
I interviewed him, and what a character. I think he took me out to some rock venue, and we were somewhere and he was showing me the world, and it's probably a world that I couldn't relate to and didn't really understand. Mm. But I've certainly never seen someone with so much energy, passion and enthusiasm.
Mm.
It was his total life.
Oh, it was his life.
28 hours a day.
Yeah, and he'd get off the plane from London or LA and just go straight to the ESPY to see some band, unknown band, and just do it with such joy, you know. Amazing. And I remember saying to him a few years ago, oh, how good is this? Like, we were at some show that we'd put on together, and I said, this is just the best thing. He goes, have you fucking finally worked it out? And he said, we could be selling fucking photocopiers. Or hamburgers, as it is.
Okay, that brings us to the big question. The Bergenomics test.
Yep.
Tell me how a day on the green, what effect it has on a simple hamburger. So I ask all of my guests,
I've got so many hamburger stories for you.
Okay.
If you've got a minute, actually.
Go for it.
First of all, we had our 500 show recently and grilled hamburgers, which is a great chain of hamburger shops. They cook sliders for us in our 500 club, we called it, which is our friends and family of A Day in the Green and supporters. So they were cooked us a whole lot of free burgers. Plus they had their Airstream burger.
An Airstream is?
The big silver caravans. They've converted that to a kitchen.
Yep.
So they had their burger there. McDonald's get smashed after our shows, wherever. If you go to McDonald's in Orange after A Day in the Green, or Mudgee, or wherever, McDonald's is pumping. Absolutely pumping. We'd sometimes go to McDonald's in Ringwood on the way back from the Yarra Valley. We walk in, and you just see so many casualties from A Day in the Green. They're packed. The best hamburger story is my little mate over here at Andrew's Hamburgers in Albert Park. Andrew, I used to play cricket with him. He was a kid and I used to pick him up. He used to be a leg spinner. And biggest Rick Astley fan. Hassled me all the time about when's Rick Astley coming? Because when he was eight, he's a little Greek guy, his cousins were going to see Rick Astley at the Palais. He thought he was going. He was all dressed up and ready to go. The cousins came over, didn't have a ticket for him, burst into tears, 8 years old. The next time Rick Astley tours, this is like 15 years later, he's the only show Greg could go to, this is the kid, was the Chelsea Heights Hotel. You know that one down there?
Actually, I haven't been there.
That's it. I haven't either, but I've driven past it. But anyway, Rick was playing there, which is totally the wrong place for him to play anyway. So Greg's all excited, goes down to the Chelsea Heights Hotel, pumped. Like, this guy's a real fan, big fan. At the show, guy walks on the stage. Ladies and gentlemen, we're very sorry. Rick can't perform tonight. He has a very bad case of food poisoning. Still doesn't get to see Rick Astley. That's why he keeps hassling me. So fast forward, I say, okay, Rick, I got Rick Astley, Greg. He's coming. We're going to do this tour with A-ha. And he's beside himself. And he goes, oh my God. So we get, so that's that. So he's the owner of Andrew's Hamburgers, right? So I get to Perth, meet Rick and A-ha for the first show of the tour. I tell Rick the story. And I didn't want to say too much, but I was hoping he would say, and he did. He goes, let's go and get a hamburger, right? So we set it up. Rick's doing the ABC, then he's got to do the project after that. So he's got an hour off. So I set it up with Greg's mum. I said, Mrs. Pappas, Rick Astley's coming into the store. Greg has to be here at 6 o'clock on Wednesday night or whatever it was, right? So it's pumping in there. I've got Rick outside. It's like two or three deep in the hamburger store. Greg's behind the grill, very busy. I walk in with Rick. Greg sort of half turns around, said, who's next? And Rick puts his hand up and says, I am. Greg looks, he drops the spatula, whatever he's working with, starts shaking. Rick goes around the counter. Greg can't believe it. He's like beside himself. And anyway, Rick has the burger. Greg gives him a t-shirt. They have a photo out the front of them together in Andrew's Hamburger t-shirt. It gets into the Daily Mail on page 3 in London. And he was just so happy, right? And then Rick says, we leave the burger joint and Rick says, I'm going to do the project. I've got to do a live performance. I'm going to wear the t-shirt. I said, oh, gold. So I ring Greg and I said, Rick's about to get on the project. You should watch it. So he's turned it on. He's got the Andrews hand. He's never, like, I get hamburgers free for life at Andrew's Hamburgers, as do my staff. So that's a real good hamburger story for you.
That's the best one.
But we have, you know, obviously, yeah, I know what you're saying. You're just saying that whatever impact you have economically reflects in the good old purchase of a hamburger. Yeah, nice.
Mickey Newton, thank you.
Thank you, Ross.
For joining us. You have demystified the live outdoor event business.
Well, if it was easy, everyone would do it. Let's put it that way. But it's fun. I'm still enjoying it.
Terrific. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks.
Cheers.
It was great to catch up with a close friend, Mick Newton, to peer into the economics of the mysterious world of live music events. The risks Mick has endured to stage 500 A Day on the Green festivals, I personally find daunting. Patrons expect absolute 100% delivery from many aspects outside of Mick's control. Perfect weather, faultless artistic performances, plentiful local accommodation, and no traffic jams with thousands of cars to be parked. In any enterprise, the higher the risk, the higher the return. But I never would have guessed profit margins are so slim in live events. Artist fees representing up to 60% of the total event cost. And historically, artist contracts have been negotiated in US dollars, meaning if the exchange rate moves against the Aussie dollar, the total profit of the event can be wiped out. Whether Mick's event makes a profit or loss, the total value of the event injects three times that amount into the economy. Lastly, never before has the Burgonomics test been explained with such immediate economic impact. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the Burgonomics podcast on Apple and Spotify and pass it on to others who you think may enjoy the demystification of economics. Jump onto our Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram and TikTok feeds with your opinion. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.